This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Modern warfare. The wild thing is, if you go back to World War II, let's say, they were learning how to fight modern warfare, modern for its time. And something that's always fascinated me, maybe I'm just a huge nerd, probably am, is how fast warfare changes. Speaking of World War II, battleships. What's cooler than a battleship, right? And before World War II, battleships were everything. In World War II, yes, they were used, but battleship? Not near as important as an aircraft carrier. If I have an aircraft carrier full of planes and you have a battleship with all these guns on it, you're going to die. But fast forward to today. We've had recently two major conflicts, one still going on the globe, Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Gaza. I want to know how those wars were fought. I want to know the advancements in technology. We have AI now coming into play, drones, counter-drone technology. I want to know, or at least I want some idea, what future wars will look like. And the reason I'm fascinated by this is when I look back at all these other wars that we fought throughout history, it seems that major powers most of the time, in certain ways, get caught with their pants down because they weren't quite ready for the new thing in warfare. So what is the new thing? You can say, well, we fought in Iraq, we fought in Afghanistan. It's 20 years ago. Things have changed already, and things will change tomorrow. We thought it would be interesting. We thought it'd be interesting to bring a couple experts on and break some of this down for us. How have these wars been going? What does the future look like? What's happening in places like drones, online, Russia, Ukraine? Let's dig into that. We'll talk to John Spencer next. I love my cell phone company. I am so big on hiring Americans. As we wake up every single day and we look at the news and we find out about this corporation, fired 1,000 Americans, hired 1,000 foreigners. This corporation gets busted for having all these illegals. I have grown more and more aware as I age about companies that prioritize hiring Americans. American jobs for Americans. That's what PureTalk does. When you make the switch to PureTalk, when you switch from Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, when you get a hold of someone on the phone at PureTalk, it's almost striking how pleasant they are and how they speak English. They understand it. You know why? Because they're Americans, right here in America. PureTalk makes it a priority to keep American jobs in America, and I love that. Make the switch. Save some money. Prioritize America. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. Well, as I mentioned in the open, war changes. I mean, anybody who's read any history at all about the history of warfare knows that it changes, and those changes can be jarring when you find yourself in a new conflict. And we've had two real fairly major wars, still have, I guess, in the case of Russia, Ukraine recently. And I have been banging my head off the desk trying to get some actual analysis of the combat on the ground. It's, war is so emotional. All you get is this person's propaganda and that person's I just want to know what's happening. I want to know what happened in Gaza. I want to know what's happening in Russia, Ukraine. Joining me now, somebody who can actually give that to us, John Spencer, Executive Director of the Urban Warfare Institute. John, before we get to the conflicts, tell us about you.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me, Jesse. So I spent 25 years in the U.S. Army as an infantry soldier. I did my own combat deployments in the invasion of Iraq and later during the sectarian violence in Baghdad. So I have my own urban warfare experiences. But over a decade ago, I was working in the Pentagon for a four-star general, started focusing academically, looking at the history of urban warfare, urbanization around the world, population growth. I transitioned then to be teaching strategy at West Point, where I created a research center called the Modern War Institute, started focusing for over a decade on writing, researching, visiting urban battlefields, and really becoming the guy. And interestingly, that the world doesn't have people that study specifically urban warfare nowhere, for many reasons. And we'll probably talk about the evolutions of urban warfare, people don't want to do it. So we haven't invested in really the study of it, the experts in it, and everything. That leads me to my current job, which is continuing to build the body of knowledge on urban warfare and traveling into war zones, which is a unique type of research that I started doing in 2018 when I retired from the military, but kept working on different research projects.
Okay, well, let's dig into that right now before we get into these other two conflicts, specifically urban warfare. I've only done a little bit of it in the Marine Corps, training for it, doing a little bit of it. I've done enough of it to know it's freaking awful, absolutely awful. Why?
It's a great question, and I actually stood up a course in this evolution as well to teach the only division-level course to teach why is urban warfare hard and how, what, whenever we met success and or not success, and each one of the services, each military of the world has their own different history with urban warfare, you know, Marine Corps and like Way and Fallujah and other places, the U.S. Army and as well in World War II and Aachen and other places. I mean, it's so hard across the evolutions of warfare. Urban warfare really dates back as old as warfare itself. And some of the earliest writings on warfare in general in Egypt are about fighting outside of cities and evolving to, you know, castle siege warfare, where the objective is the city inside of the castle, and continuing to evolve to why we have militaries is to move forward of our cities and attack the military that's approaching, so we don't have a fight in our city, because that's where the costs are, that's where the political capital is, that's where the economic engine of nations is. There's many reasons why the objective has always been urban, but we don't have a long history of fighting in cities. We have a long history of fighting for cities. Of course, as warfare, like you said, changed, so did where did warfare occur start to change. You know, World War One, you have Verdun. World War Two, you really start to see major battles for actual cities as the logistical hubs or the political capitals, if you're sieging a nation. And you have major urban battles like Stalingrad, Leningrad, American experiences in Aachen, around Bastogne, and you keep evolving. But there's something that happens really, you know, post-World War II, even the laws of war change. We don't, although we destroyed lots of cities in World War II, if you think back to like Dresden, Tokyo, others where cities are targeted to try to compel governments to do the will of the other force. The law of war changed as well, but that urban warfare continued and actually increased for many reasons. Really, after the Korean War, which saw a lot of urban warfare as well, we had some massive shifts in population and urbanization growth. I mean, it took until 1960, basically, for the world to hit 3 billion. But by 1999, we're at 6 billion. So 4 decades later, we double the population of the entire globe. And we also increased cities, where we had in the 1950, like 50 cities of 1 million. Now we have 250. And as warfare evolved, yes, we had Vietnam and you had Wei and Saigon and a few other urban battles, but you still had mostly fighting outside of the urban areas. As the world continued to urbanize and population growth, you saw military shrinking as well. So that becomes also an issue of why it's so hard. But the simple answer, Jesse, on why urban warfare is so hard is because it's as we have evolved as nations and as militaries and as war has evolved, it's where the military doesn't want to go because it's where the civilian population is. And really, the laws of war were created to limit the brutality of war on those not involved, the civilians and their homes and infrastructure and everything. So once you enter an urban area, it's already going to be the place where militaries are constrained. It's also ready-made combat in hell, and lots of, you know, U.S. forces, Marines, and others have annotated that in the archives, is that's where your weapons get negated, your ability to maneuver, your ability to mass, your ability to see and shoot things, to be ambushed. In the urban terrain, that concrete jungle, whoever's in there already, no matter what size they are, they already have an advantage and can contest that ground. But really, it's so hard because it's where the restrictions on the use of force, and where the defender, if they get there first, has such an advantage. And that's what we've seen as we've seen major peer-on-peer or non-state actor versus state actor wars increasing in urban areas. It's for those reasons. They are the prize, and they are also in the way, because as we've seen in Ukraine, you're having urban battles in places where in World War II you didn't, because there wasn't an urban area there before. Even the Battle of Kyiv, it's the largest encirclement in history during World War II, and then becomes basically the defeat of the Russian objective in the early Ukrainian war. So there's a long list of reasons, Jesse, but it's the main reason is that people don't want to fight there, so that's where the fighting is starting to happen.
Then let's go to Ukraine. Let's go to this Russia-Ukraine thing. Just like the other conflict we will get to eventually, it's just I found it so frustrating because military tactics and things like that fascinate me, and I like to know what's coming in the future. It's hard to get accurate information. You have all propaganda from here and propaganda from there, and this country's propaganda. I want to know what the actual combat has been like on the ground, and what lessons have we learned as Russia and Ukraine have been killing each other. John, the floor is yours.
So, to summarize, the problem with Ukraine as an analyst is that everybody now takes it for as seen in Ukraine. You really have to go through the evolutions of the different 2.5, now 3+ years of fighting. I specifically got on the ground immediately after the Russians were defeated at Kyiv, right, the capital city. And had Russia developed a plan and war test all militaries to take Kyiv very deliberately, then we might not be having the war we have now. You might have an urban insurgency or something like that. But Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022 with over 200,000 forces. That sounds like a lot. But if you really look at the force ratios required to take a city in general versus the size of the city, let alone the defenders, and will the population that is present, which most militaries discount, resist, help, or be neutral and just hide? That's what we saw in the first 6 months or so of the war, is that Russia attempted a coup d'etat. It tried to take Ukraine as a nation, to include the president's statement. So a lot of people have done a revisionist history on why Putin invaded Ukraine and what he wants. He said it on the night of the invasion. He wanted to take the nation, illegitimate government, to denazify it, whatever. As an analyst, and as you with military history will know, I looked at, that's the goal. How are you going to do it? And he used over 200,000 Russian forces that hadn't been tested in a long time, and he tried to take 7 separate cities simultaneously. Now, I got on the ground in Kyiv immediately after the Russians withdrew in April of 2022 to see why couldn't they take this capital city. Yes, it's a city of 3 million, but other cities like Baghdad of 6 million and others had been taken with much less forces. And there were a lot of contributing factors, but the population centers got in the way, the Murphy got in the way, things didn't work out the way that the Russians wanted to take Kyiv, and the civilians resisted. So when you have tens of thousands of former Soviet soldiers, conscripts, Ukrainian civilians that have AK-47s, then it doesn't matter what your fancy little brigade of mechanized forces is doing, it's going to run into problems. And that's what you saw in, even Mariupol fell, but you saw Sumy, Kharkiv, all these cities holding. And the sheer geography of Ukraine and what was attempted was also not discussed as much as people thought. As we study world wars and you have millions of soldiers, most militaries of the world have shrunk, and there are a lot of ideals about what can be done with a smaller, more technologically advanced, more lethal, more firepower force. But if you're going to take a city, you still need troops. And Russia found that out. Now, that once Russia was defeated in April of 2022, then they changed their objectives. They pulled out of all of the major cities and redirected their forces for eastern and really southern Ukraine, and started an offensive there after they regrouped. Ukraine went into basically counteroffensive in the spring of 2023, leading into the summer, and they had some successes. But then Russia, using very Russian Soviet doctrine, went into building defensives, massive defensive lines to hold the ground that they had seized in the eastern portions of Ukraine. And this is what we've seen now evolve into a very positional World War I-esque trench lines. But there are so many variables going on in Ukraine. It's still about city fights. I mean, the Battle of Bakhmut, Russians lost 40,000 plus soldiers to take a city with really no tactical or operational advantage. But that's the history of urban warfare as well, is that they become outsized political objectives and what everybody talks about. And there are some urban battles happening in Ukraine right now. But those defensive lines, which are really hard to penetrate when both sides don't have air power. So there's no air power on either side. Nobody can get air supremacy, air superiority, which really changes everything in warfare, right? The whole concept of World War II breaking of the trench lines, maneuver warfare, the blitzkrieg, the combination of the tank, the airplane, radio communication, and stormtroop tactics. No, neither side can do that, so you have very protracted fights. You also saw Ukrainian military go from 100,000 forces basically in 2022 to 1 million in order to fight at this scale in the terrain of the Russian forces, which started at 200,000, then they started feeding hundreds of thousands of forces into these defensive lines they were building, rapidly mobilizing, taking people out of prisons and off the streets to build this war in flight, basically. But of course, everybody likes to talk about the drones, which, as somebody who studies more than one conflict at once, I mean, drones are an evolution of air power. You can call it the cheap man's air force. Ukraine had been investing in drones before, and they actually used some very powerful drones in the early parts of the war and then rapidly increased their production of drones. But in summary, Jesse, I mean, all the casualty figures are hidden. You have over 1 million casualties is what they believe. If you take up both sides, your Russians, 400,000, likely taking more casualties than the Ukrainians. But this is also war. This isn't warfare. I can talk to you about all the different urban fights that have happened in Ukraine. War is the pursuit of political objectives using all forms of national power. Your allies do matter. The fact that Ukraine has over 50 allies, Russia has very few. The fact that Russia's had to dip into Iran, artillery rounds from North Korea, North Korean soldiers. It isn't the great power that people like to believe it is, in even fighting in Ukraine. And until you have some breakthrough that isn't seen so far, you have a protracted contest over a very giant piece of geography with relatively small armies compared to the history of warfare in this type of fighting.
All right, John, I have a feeling you and I could discuss this all day long, and I would greatly enjoy that. But sadly, we are limited, and I still haven't gotten to the other conflict that's even more emotional for people for a variety of reasons, and I totally understand all those reasons. But I don't care about all the emotions. I want to know about the combat. The modern but small Israeli army went down into Gaza and then had to go underneath Gaza to fight a terrorist force in tunnels. And 99.99% of people don't have any idea what the combat was like, what were the tactics, because of all the emotions around it. John, once again, my show is yours. What happened in Gaza?
So what happened in Gaza, as somebody who studies urban warfare for a very long time, over a decade, hundreds of articles, case studies, the idea faced in Gaza, something that no military has ever faced in the history of urban warfare, and I'm talking going back to ancient antiquity, is in Gaza, while it's a relatively small piece of ground, 25 miles long, 5 to 7 miles wide, there's a military in that area, a very large military of over 40,000 Hamas fighters, broken up against 5 brigades all across the Gaza Strip, in 25 different battalions. Now, Gaza is not the densest place on earth, but it's a heavily urbanized area with 24 cities, 5 cities are over 300,000, Gaza City of 1 million. Just the scale of the urban terrain was going to be a lot for the IDF to face. So That really matters. If you look at the history of urban warfare, most of the urban fights are meeting engagements. Stalingrad, you have a million man military versus a military man that meet in the city. In Gaza City, you had something very unique, which is every inch of that ground prepared for war. 20 plus years of preparation. Yes, and an underground network that nobody's ever seen in the history of war either, right? So over 400, if not up to 600 miles, they're still discovering it every day, of tunnels in Gaza underneath every structure. I've now been into Gaza 6 times, embedded with the IDF, and it was more likely than not, every step I took, there was a tunnel underneath me. And these tunnels run from just underneath almost every building to over 200 feet underground. Some are 5 miles long, a mile long, just like basically cities underneath cities, and like a spider web, or what's the right analogy? Because nobody in the world has even a transit system, a metro system, not New York City, Seoul, nobody of this scale underneath such a small area of ground. So the IDF, as a combatant force who is moving into enemy-held cities, let's not forget the rockets, because Hamas launched 4,000 rockets at Gaza or at Israel. And if you haven't been there, you're talking like a couple football fields away. You can see it. Hamas launched 4,000 rockets on the opening morning of October 7th and never stopped, really. I mean, over 13,000 rockets since the war began coming out of Gaza. Some of those landing inside of Gaza, killing civilians. But just the enemy sit temp or the enemy situation of a 20-year prepared defense, not just the underground, but every building in some way being militarized as a connector, as a cache for weapons, every hospital being used by direction of Hamas. This is a form of what's called lawfare, back to those restrictions on the use of warfare that I talked about. Hamas reverse engineered the laws of war to try to hide, not just in the population, but in the protected sites like hospitals, schools, mosques, and everything else. And lastly, and this is on, I'm talking October 8th, the one thing that the IDF faced in Gaza that nobody else has faced is a trapped population. On the opening days, Egypt initially thought they were going to let civilians out of Gaza Strip, the 2 million civilians, which is, sounds like a lot, but I fought in a Baghdad neighborhood called Sadr City of 2 million, just within the city. But because Egypt said that no civilians could come out of Gaza, you had 2 million civilians, some of those involved in the hostilities, as in either are Hamas or a part of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and many other terrorist groups that are in the city. And they're trapped, so the IDF had to move forward, stop the rockets, try to retrieve their 250 hostages, all entering an environment prepared for defense and offense with this super tunnel network, but also 20,000 rockets and years of supplies, militarized supplies, RPGs, sniper rifles, heavy machine guns, all of that. And now you have to go in as a military, like you said, a relatively small military. They initially only used three divisions to attack this massive enemy while you're trying to protect your hostages and move civilians out of harm's way. That's what the IDF faced. And on the opening days, they started getting criticized for even going into the environment, as in going into Gaza to retrieve their hostages, to destroy the military force that just invaded Israel, and to make sure that a new situation is created so that a threat like that never happens, or an attack like that never happens again. Now, because I was the urban warfare guy, I became the guy who started saying, what you mainstream media, United Nations, human rights group are saying isn't right about the history of urban warfare or even what the IDF are doing. Like the fact that I can say, and I can still say today, that the IDF have done more to protect civilians in urban warfare, as in more what we call civilian harm mitigation measures, than any military in the history, to include the U.S. military, to be frank, in the about not just how they do evacuations, as in giving notice to everybody to get out of a certain city or a neighborhood because that's where the Hamas are that I need to attack, but the way they do the roof knocking, the way that they do daily pauses during the battles, the way that they do targeting, just this long list of over 20 things that they do called civilian harm mitigation measures that no military has ever tried before. Yes, we've all dropped flyers on cities and told civilians, if we have the time and it doesn't disadvantage the military objective, because when I invaded Iraq in 2003, we didn't give advance notice and time for civilians to get out of cities. We, of course, follow all the laws of war, but that's not a requirement. But because of the context of Gaza, that was a necessity to get the civilians out of harm's way and at least get them to the areas where the IDF weren't initially maneuvering towards. And this is what we've seen. And despite all of these never seen before in urban warfare history variables, the IDF prosecuted the war very discriminatively, and I think actually less than we would have had there been an October 7th on our border, based on the size of our military, our national interest to achieve those same goals of returning our hostages, defeating that military, and making sure they don't ever get the idea to do it again. The IDF doesn't have that type of combat power, so they did it methodically, area by area, and surprisingly, despite that underground cities, despite the fact that every neighborhood is a trap, basically, of IEDs and caches and fighters popping, you know, suicidal fighters popping up everywhere, this is what the IDF faced on a day-to-day basis. They still succeeded using very creative tactics, techniques, procedures, but also just resolve to destroy the Hamas's military. Now, Hamas is also an idea, but from a military perspective, Hamas's military doesn't exist anymore. There's no leadership that was a part of October 6th that's still alive. Like, there's maybe one brigade commander, I think, is the most of the formations can't conduct military operations at all, not organized. Just they went into guerrilla warfare during the war, which is not surprising. But yes, they've increased the recruitment. But this goes back to what are the tactics of Hamas? Of course, the tunnel warfare is the tactics, but also the deployment of child soldiers. The average Hamas recruit right now is 15 to 16. The use of human shields, the use of information operations, which is really what we've seen, not new as well. It's just the amount of production of media that Hamas does, the daily counting of anybody who's died for any reason and blaming on Israel, but also just make up numbers and statistics and statistical warfare. But despite all of that, Israel has actually had a lot of success. I mean, as we're talking, there's one hostage body remaining in Gaza. Hamas doesn't have a military. It has a coercive power over the population for now. It doesn't have a vast array of supplies. It's been cut off. The Egypt border has been sealed. But what's been surprising about this whole war, unlike even Ukraine war, because Russians attacked Mariupol and attacked hospitals and everything, the population, of course, moved and had a way to move, and they moved into other countries, has been the misinformation about the war in Gaza. You're right, we shouldn't do emotions. That's normal. In this evolution of the history of urban warfare, too, there's never been a battle, let alone a war, that's been fought at this amount of transparency or even propaganda misinformation capability because of TikTok and other algorithm-driven mediums of that Hamas fed. So Hamas had a wing of its military, the propaganda wing, that had Hollywood crews that would go out and create capture. They call it Gazawood or Pallywood, and create scenarios of dead bodies, either real or not, of starvation and everything, and feed the algorithm based on what was trending. That's unique in war. While information operation has always been there in war, but war is hell. War is awful, destruction and killing. And no matter how many civilians you try to get out of harm's way, civilians and other young women, children, everything, had other wars been fought like the Korean War, where 2 million civilians die in 37 months, that's 54,000 civilians a month, every month of the war, and just awful scenes. Had that been fed to the phones of every living individual, billions, wars might have went in a different direction. So despite that there is an Israeli standard to war, that aspect of the information operations and everybody saying, well, look at this dead body. John Spencer, what do you say about this dead child right here? I'm like, I say that's terrible. I also say that the algorithm is now driving every one of those images to you, and not all of those are real, but this is the unique, not only is there misinformation, there's an access to this war at a scale, again, unprecedented in the urban environment that nobody's seen, which has led to emotions being fed by real concern, but also being fed by misinformation, disinformation, and all this other unique created things of like trying to use statistical warfare, but you know, saying how many people died, irrelevant whether they were participating in the hostilities, whether you call them a combatant or just involved or not, or you know, their age, their sex, and just trying to fight these moral equivalency war against Israel, who of course has the legitimate right to defend itself, to retrieve its hostages, but also to execute the war in a very just, humane, law-abiding way, but then for the entire kind of global misinformation thing to try to say they're not, even when they don't have the access to the information, which is really, again, where I came in, is like, I don't want to listen to anybody. I want to see it from my own eyes, and bed with the IDF and see what's going on.
John, that was friggin' awesome, man. Thank you, brother. I wish to keep you for longer. I appreciate you very much. We're not done yet. We have someone else next. Let me lay this out for you. 3 months, 90 days. What if in 3 months you could have great energy all day long? Not just in the morning after a good night's sleep. I'm talking after lunch too, when you want to take a nap. What if you just felt good? At work all the time, you're not staring at the clock. I can't wait to get a... What if you just felt good all day long? I'm telling you right now, a chalk male vitality stack or female vitality stack is life-changing. Natural herbal supplements. I think it's been 4 years I've been taking one every single day. It has changed my life. I'm better at work. I'm better at home. On the weekends, I don't want to lay around. It's just so nice. And to do it without needles in your arm or pills or something, try it. 90 days is all I'm asking. Try it. Chuck.com/JesseTV. The future of warfare, as we've been talking about, I find it to be fascinating. Horrifying, of course, but I'd like to try to know what might be coming. Joining me now, somebody who's all over this stuff, open source intelligence analyst Ryan Macbeth. Would highly, highly recommend his YouTube channel if you nerd out on this stuff like I do, Ryan Macbeth Programming. Ryan, I can't help it. I'm a huge nerd for this stuff. I look back at past wars and I see how things change and it gets people killed and you're all over this stuff. In fact, you have a video out. Yes, I watched it. Talking about how war in 2026 doesn't look like what you think it will look like. What do you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we tend to think of conflict in the terms of people shooting at each other, but there is another type of conflict, the Gerasimov Doctrine or hybrid war. This is something that Russia pioneered, where they use lawfare, legal methods, they use information warfare, and they use different kinds of kinetic actions to create effects on target. And good example is, let's say you don't want the US sending 155 millimeter shells to Ukraine. Well, one way of preventing that might be to use a bomber and launch a cruise missile against the factory in Scranton, Pennsylvania. That would be a way of destroying the factory, and now you can't send 155 millimeter artillery shells to Ukraine. But that would get the United States involved in a war with Russia, and Russia doesn't want that because we would probably end it in about 36 hours. So what you could also do is put information out on social media and say, half of all 155 millimeter shells are actually going to cartels in Mexico. Ukraine is selling them to these cartels. Now, I haven't seen any cartels with 155 millimeter cannons, but if enough people believe it, they call their congressman, and then the congressman gets or prevents more shells being sent to Ukraine. So the effect is the same, which is why I've always said information warfare is a weapons effector.
I love that, although it does terrify me, especially when I consider, and I'm learning more about this stuff from my kids, I'm technology stupid, but every day they tell me about there's some new app, there's some new thing, and I'm serious, there's always something new that I'd never heard of before. There's so much information, so many social media sites out there. It is scary to think about bad regimes figuring out ways to weaponize it, but they're all in on this, aren't they?
I believe so. Right now, I am looking for information. I have software running on Renee Nicole Good, who was the woman who was shot by ICE agents in Minneapolis. And what's kind of interesting is that a very specific word keeps popping up, the word legal observer. And so I've been tracking that word and seeing who is repeating the word legal observer. Because it sounds like that is something that is scripted, and that might be scripted internally, or there may be external influencers such as Russia or China or Iran that are trying to get Americans angry at each other. And the word legal observer kind of sounds like someone who's holding up a cell phone and auditing the police, you know, that kind of thing. And if everyone is on the same page, well, that kind of tells you that someone has either seeded this information or is directing this information. And there is a term that I call likership. And I've often said that there are some people in Congress that practice likership, not leadership. And that is when they say, they give their hot take on Twitter or on whatever, people like their comments. And they go, oh yes, I must be really smart because people liked my comment. I got 1,000 likes on this. And getting that like, getting that validation is a very powerful incentive for a lot of people. So if someone sees the word legal observer trending, they might think, oh, that might get me a lot of likes too. And now this information keeps flowing and flowing, and more people could get fooled.
Told you this guy was fascinating. Ryan, what are semiconductors? It sounds like something I would hold up to get lightning to strike it. What are they, and why should I care?
Well, you could say microchips, right? So Taiwan, one of the reasons that we're very interested in defending Taiwan, we just sold them more HIMARS systems, more missile systems. Semiconductors are in the device that I'm talking to you on right now. My camera is an old iPhone. My computer has semiconductors. My cell phone right here has semiconductors in it. This microphone that I'm using has semiconductors. So if we enjoy our American way of life with all sorts of tech, I mean, my washing machine plays a little song when it's done. Now, that isn't an advanced semiconductor that you might find in a computer, but it is still a semiconductor. And Taiwan produces 90% of semiconductors that are used by technology that we have in our computers that we use in our everyday life. So having semiconductors and the ability to manufacture semiconductors is crucial for defending your nation. Semiconductors today are the steel of World War II.
So how many do we make?
We don't make that many. Taiwan makes about 90%. Of our advanced semiconductors. I can't really give you a number in the millions. We just recently opened up a fab. We're starting to open up a fab in, I believe it was Arizona. That was an Intel fab. And I think NVIDIA wants to create a fab here as well. Now, that was part of the CHIPS Act, which was a bipartisan act that was passed to kind of subsidize that. The problem is that it takes a lot of startup time and a lot of skill. And semiconductors, When you look at how they're manufactured, it is incredibly labor-intensive, incredibly water-intensive, incredibly power-intensive, and it's not easy. People have said that some of the semiconductor manufacturing machines from ASML, which is a Dutch company, that there's explosives inside the fabs, in Taiwan. So if the Chinese invade, they'll just cut off the, set off the explosives and destroy the building. And you could probably stop semiconductor manufacturing by just blowing on the machine wrong, because these machines are highly calibrated. And ASML contractors, they fly to Taiwan periodically and they maintain the machines. So if you shut down the machine incorrectly, you might not be able to start it up again without an ASML contractor coming over and rewiring the machine, checking it to make sure it's okay. So semiconductors are incredibly important to America's wartime strategies and our ability to build weapons.
They need a lot of water, so we put it in Arizona. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. All right, Ryan, drone capability. Obviously, drones are something that even normies know about drones and how much drones are being used in places like Russia, Ukraine. My interest is in countering them. Eventually, every weapons system gets a counter to it. What is the counter to drones? Is there one yet?
Well, there is a number of different counters to drones. The first is electronic warfare. You know, you're jamming the signal that drone is using to be controlled. So if I set off a drone, I fly that drone, I can use electronic warfare to override that signal, and the drone will theoretically fall out of the air. Another way is with anti-drone jammers that are handheld. In that case, I point a thing, it looks like a gun, I point it at the drone, and I pull the trigger, and I essentially send every single shutdown code, every single transmitted shutdown code in memory to that drone. Eventually, the correct one hits and that drone shuts down and falls out of the sky. Then there's other kinds of interceptors, such as you can use counter-drone drones. And these drones will either crash into the drone directly, shoot at the drone with essentially a modified shotgun, or fire a net at that drone. The net method might actually be a good way for police to take down drones. Well, that's a little shaky because the FAA considers drones to be aircraft. So imagine the police shooting down an aircraft, right? The FCC or the FAA doesn't really have a consider a difference. And of course, the fourth way would be through kinetic action, shooting it down with missiles or shooting it down with gunfire. And there's issues with that. If you're using a regular missile, many of those missiles are extremely expensive. If you fire a $100,000 missile at a $20,000 drone, you're on the losing end of that economic equation. And if you shoot at a drone with a gun, I mean, that's great, but you might not be able to hit it, and that bullet has to come down somewhere. So really the most effective way of countering drones is using other drones.
Gosh, I want a drone that shoots nets so bad now. Ryan, thank you, brother. I appreciate it, as always. Come back soon, please. All right, final thoughts next. I love chips. Everyone who knows me would describe me as not just being a robe guy, but a chip guy. I'm a chip freak. But that's a problem, you see, because I'm also 44, and I'm not 24 anymore, and chips generally are terrible for you. I've always been that guy. Gas station, grabbing some chips. Grocery store, grabbing some chips. Can't do that anymore. Have you read the ingredients? Have you read the ingredients on the back of your chip bag? It's horrifying. So what to do, what to do? I'm not giving up chips. I don't have to give up chips. I have Massa chips now. Massa chips. Chips I can eat guilt-free. Look at the back of a bag of Massa chips. No seed oil filth. It's tallow. It's corn. And they're fantastic. The crunch. They're so crunchy. You want a perfect snack? Bag of Massa chips, little thing of hot sauce, little dab on there, all you need. Go try them. MassaChips.com/JesseTV. War is terrifying, but it's also interesting. Let's be honest. We're interested in it. I am. You are. And not just the past, the future. When the next major war breaks out, and there's always going to be one, what is it going to look like? I'm glad we're a little bit smarter now than we were an hour ago. This is not the last time we're going to do something like this, because I geek out on it. I know you geek out on it, but I enjoyed it, and we'll do it again. Let's see.